Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is recording engineer and artisan baker, Randall Michael Tobin. But let's start here. You probably know the vinyl records have made a huge comeback, and now CDs and even cassettes are seeing a resurgence as well. But those aren't the only physical formats that artists and labels are using these days. Maybe the most unique is from a Kentucky thrash metal band called Belushi Speedball, who just released its latest single in the form of a slice of pizza. Yeah, you heard me right. A slice of pizza. It's available in two styles, Detroit or New York, and it has the band's song, My Favorite Color is Pizza, which comes in the form of a piece of slice preserved in resin, complete with a tiny speaker and a play button. They're charging $75 for each slice. The band is actually part of something called Pizza Thrash, which is a subgenre of thrash metal, and that's a name for bands that lean on cultural references from the 80s. If that's not weird enough for you, there are artists that are actually releasing music on 3.5-inch floppy disks. Yes, floppy disks. These come from floppy-only online labels like Floppy Kick out of Hungary and Floppy Total out of the Netherlands. Each disc is numbered as part of a limited run. There were actually more than 500 floppy disk releases last year alone, and there are almost 2,300 floppy releases listed on discogs.com. The music on most of these releases are electronic, but other genres include hip-hop, a smattering of classical and jazz, a bunch of metal subgenres, and non-music like experimental field recordings from Norway and spoken word from China. Because blank floppies are getting so difficult to get, this release format is fast becoming a collector's item, which just goes to show you that you should never write off a physical release format. The moment you do, you just know it will come back. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, I'm pleased to announce that my new Musicians AI Handbook is now available. It's packed with information about how AI can help you with new song, lyric, mixing, and mastering ideas, as well as music marketing to help you get your music out to the audience that you deserve. To get your copy, go to bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. That's bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. You can also find it on Amazon and Apple Books. Now, the ancient Greek philosopher Pythagoras wrote about the relationship between simple numbers like 3 and 4 that musically produced what we know today as consonants. This forms the basis of our 12-tone scale that's been a constant in Western music since about 600 BC. Scholars have constantly tried to find psychological explanations for this, but these integer ratios are still credited with making a chord sound beautiful, and any deviation from them is thought to make music dissonant or unpleasant sounding. Well, researchers from the University of Cambridge, Princeton, and the Max Planck Institute for Empirical Aesthetics have now discovered that there are two key ways in which Pythagoras was wrong. It turns out that in normal listening, we actually don't prefer chords to be perfectly in these mathematical ratios. We prefer slight amounts of deviation. We like a little imperfection because this gives life to the sounds, and that's attractive to us. We've all actually proved this to ourselves many times, even though you probably never thought about it. If you ever tried to double a vocal or an instrument, you've probably noticed that if the double is too perfect, it doesn't sound as good as one that's slightly off. The same thing with the chorus effect that adds a subtle pitch and timing difference in order to generate that chorus sound. Yet another example is when we have a synthesizer with tunable oscillators like a mini Moog. It always sounds bigger and fuller when one oscillator is slightly detuned from the other. The study's findings challenge the traditional idea that harmony can only be one way, and that chords have to reflect these traditional mathematical relationships. It turns out that there are many more kinds of harmony used around the world, and that there are good reasons why other cultures develop them. Point is, don't always assume that what we think is correct in Western music applies to all music. There are many more choices to be aware of. My guest this week is Randall Michael Tobin, who founded his Theta Sound Studio way back in 1977. Since then, he's worked on thousands of projects in various genres, including jazz, pop, R&B, classical, hip-hop, country, ragtime, gospel, ballet, alternative, film score, and spoken word. Besides offering just about every audio service you can think of, Randall also offers art and graphics, online marketing and promotion, video production and editing, and website design and maintenance. But there's more to Randall's story. Along the way, his interest in artisan cooking led him to begin baking sourdough bread loaves that he gave as gifts to clients and friends. This eventually led to a side business called Random Acts of Breadness, where, as an artisan baker, Randall sells sourdough bread along with delicious compliments like raw farm butters, honey spreads, jams, and organic extra virgin olive oils. In fact, I eat at least one piece of Randall's most excellent sourdough just about every day. During part one of the interview, we spoke about how some gear never goes out of style, recording big band, his unique studio clientele, where we got his technical chops, and much more. I spoke with Randall from his studio in Burbank, California. Let's go back to the beginning and let's talk about you getting into the music business and starting in the business.
Okay, well, music was certainly an interest and something I gravitated towards when I was young and when I was in school, when I wasn't like the most popular kid in the school because that wasn't my build. So I tend to dive into things that were interesting to me. And we had a music teacher in elementary school. You left your classroom and you went over to the music bungalow, right? And she made music interesting and exciting. And I'm so glad that I had that. And I was in the sixth grade or the elementary school band playing percussion. And I do remember playing tubular bells with the mallet and the whole thing like that, the actual chimes. And it was like, oh, this is cool. And when I got into junior high, I got into orchestra and I became a percussionist there with the vibes and xylophone, orchestral bells, drums, timpani, and the like. And we did Broadway shows with the same scores that they used on Broadway. They didn't like give us any little kiddie versions. It's like these shows were done to that standard. And the drama department too. And Danny Elfman was in my class and he actually was in drama class. And so he played lead roles and I was in orchestra. So I played percussion, but still, it was a hobby and I was getting into it. It was a way to get girls and that kind of a thing as we all, go through this phase of like, well, maybe if I can learn to play music, I won't be so lonely. But high school was a bit of a drop off, because photography class was the main thing that I enjoyed at school. And the rest of the time it was like, okay, I'm off at lunch to work at a job, which is part of, I get credit for, they call it work experience, right?
Yeah.
And I was in marching band for a semester as a walk-on playing a tenor drum, but that was about, that was about it. So I didn't really know what was going to happen when I got out of high school because I didn't want to go to college. I'm going like, I just got out of prison for 12 years. Why would I want to continue going to another prison? So as you probably read, my mom suggested going into the Air Force because my older sister had gone in the Air Force. And, like it or not, it ended up being the best thing that could have ever happened to me because it put me in a position where I had to make a decision right away, especially stepping off the plane, being hit with the blast of that San Antonio heat and humidity and the drill sergeants yelling all this shit. And I'm going, well, I know what I'm not doing the rest of my life. And that's what I needed. So music became my outlet. It's like, okay, I'm going to spend every available moment that I have when I'm not doing the Air Force thing, doing music. And it completely changed my life. I ended up meeting other musicians in the Air Force that were not an Air Force band. They were just other airmen that happened to also be musicians. I saw bands come through the clubs that would play in the service clubs. And I would, I made a decision to pick up bass all of a sudden once I was in the Air Force. It wasn't something that I did before. I was a keyboard player and a harmonica player and a percussionist. But when I saw a guy playing bass, I'm going, this is cool. I never really saw a bass up close before, And four strings. Well, so I got into it, bought an old Hagstrom bass from a pawn shop. It had nylon tape strings on it, it was nylon, black nylon.
Yeah.
And every band that came through, I'd get with them in the back and get with the bass player and say, hey, what was the most important thing for you learning bass? And I would ask. And so I was like, make sure you use your little pinky finger. You know, it's like, don't not use it, you know? And another guy would say, oh, you know, use a pick, or somebody would say, make sure you use your fingers. Whatever it was, I just took their advice and I just started working with that and playing along with records and then be really beginning to appreciate bass players like I never had appreciated them before. I'm going, wow, there's a whole lot more to this instrument than I thought. And then I got into bands when I was in the service with people who weren't in the service and were in the service. And together we played events and shows, made a little money. And then I started setting up this studio at my last duty station in Germany. And I set up a little four-track studio in my barracks. And me and another guy, we made our Sgt. Pepper magnum opus by bouncing back and forth between my TAC 3340 and a Revox two-track, quarter track. And we go back and forth and we did about three bounces. I had the foresight to actually have Dolby units, consumer Dolby units, which actually turned out not to be such a great idea when you're bouncing a lot. But in the end, that's what we ended up doing. I ended up with something that I actually thought was going to make us famous. You know?
Yeah.
It's quite ambitious what we did, me and my friend, because it was all kinds of music. It was everything from rock to pop to jazz to eclectic to whatever, all on one record. And I listen to it to this day. It's almost 50 years old, right? And it's like, damn, you know, I did that at like age 20 because we had no better. We didn't know any better, right? It's like, hey, we can do whatever we want. And I'm so glad that I had that grounding, because then when I got out of the service, the first thing I wanted to do was work in a recording studio. But nobody hired me. You know, I sent out 25 resumes and I got one answer back saying I could sweep floors and clean ashtrays. And I'm going, well, the hell with that. I've got way too much experience for that. So I started my own studio and finally somebody paid me some money and that became my first professional client. And that was August of 1977 and I haven't really looked back.
One of the things that I find interesting is that you've been in Southern California through all this and you saw some of the really cool things that happened and the cool changes that happened in music and the studio business.
Uh-huh.
And you've gone through this whole thing. Most of us are transplants and you're not. You're a native. So in fact, I think it hits you a little different than it hit us that are transplants. And when you look back, what do you think? Like, well, what's the most significant thing that happened if you look through all these evolutions or the evolution that happened?
Well, I remember when I was in the service seeing, and I subscribed to the magazines at the time. There was one called EQ. There was one called Recording. You know, these were the ones that were all like, of course, I'm going to subscribe. I subscribed to Guitar Player and Keyboard Magazine. And I remember in the Recording magazines, the ad for Tascam, you know, was like, oh my God, you know. And then the TAC and Tascam and that whole, you know, connection and just going like, wow, I could only get this four-track deck, you know, that would be the beginning, right? So that was like a huge turning point because I got that while I was in the service at a really good price because when you're in the military, they have what's called the audio club where they sold hi-fi equipment at rock bottom prices to the servicemen. It was a benefit, right?
Yeah.
So I could special order. And I said, can I special order this tape deck? And they go, yeah, because TAC also made cassette decks and other things. And so they had a line with that company. So they got me that deck for cheaper than I could have ever got it in the United States.
Wow.
And that was the first synchronization deck that you could have with the funky foot switches on the head, right?
Yeah.
But there was no mixer. So I actually created my own passive pan pot mixer in a box. So we could mix the darn thing. You know, there was no Model 2, which was the first little mixer with pan on it, right? And then that came out later. So I was excited about this whole thing about, wow, recording studio. It was a guitar player. I was playing with another guitar player who I was in a band within the Air Force who said, yeah, my friend Lenny, he's got a studio in New York. It's called Stay Sound. His name is Lenny Stay, you know? And I'm going, wow, a studio, what a trip. And it just kind of planted the seed. I wonder if I could set up a studio. So I did in my barracks. And that was the turning point. Because from that point on, I've always had a studio wherever I've lived. And when I got out of the Air Force, I actually was in Florida for a year because the friend I was playing with and we were recording together in Germany, he was part of a duo with another guy in the Air Force. And that guy's name was Rob, and they had a duo called Robinson and Douglas. And I first met Douglas when I saw the duo playing at one of the clubs on the base I was at in Germany. So when Rob got stationed in Florida at Eglin Air Force Base in Fort Walton Beach area, then we all ended up there for a year so that we could continue the trio and add a drummer and make it a quartet. And then we also did another band that was doing fusion and stuff that nobody wanted to listen to down in that part of the United States. But we loved it. And I set up a studio in the rental house where we were at. And so there was me, the guitar player, and a keyboard player friend who got out of the service, and he was an Air Force band. And he's really good. So that became our jazz fusion pop band. And then we had the soft rock band with the other guy. So after the unemployment ran out for a year and we weren't really making any money there, I was like, we come back to LA because that's where I'm from. And with the intention of starting a studio. It didn't happen immediately, but I did manage to get a gig with TFA Electrosound, which was a big touring outfit. Tom Fields Associates, a big lighting company. Electrosound was started by Ricky Farr. The story of that is that he borrowed Pink Floyd's PA system and then he repainted it and took it out on tour and brought it back and then gave it back to Pink Floyd and said, here, I painted your PA. But he used it to actually start a sound company. Right? So that company eventually became known as Electrotech. But when I was with the company, it was TFA Electrosound, and they were behind the Cinerama Dome in LA, and then A1 Audio took over that spot, and Electrosound moved into North Hollywood on Van Owen. They supported Rod Stewart, Cars, Ted Nugent, Blondie, Journey, a bunch of acts. They did the California Jam and some other stuff. And they sent me to recording school to learn how to recone speakers and drivers, JBL.
Yeah.
So I got that. I learned that. And that's what I did most of. And sometimes they'd send me out on a road gig in support. But most of the time I was just in that room chiseling speakers and mixing highly volatile chemicals and shit and reconing stuff. So I did that for a year and a half, but then I learned a lot about live sound from being there because these guys were pros. And some of their cast-off equipment I bought. Old Altec, Voice of the Theater, and this and that kind of things I bought. And I built my own custom PA, and then me and a friend started a sound company. We started doing live sound in addition to the studio. So I just found the journey to be quite interesting, that as long as I was immersed in the audio thing, I just loved what I did, and people heard what I did and they loved what I did. And that's how I ended up getting gigs and going, that sounds really good. Can I record there? And so I never even looked twice because I wasn't familiar with the big studio scene. I never had access to the million-dollar consoles, you know, the Neves, and before Neve, it was Harrison and all these other ones, and even before that. So I just was like, well, I have my little homespun thing. And then eventually I added a few more things, and now what's in my studio right now, I have two Ramza boards.
I remember them. Yeah.
Ramza and the WR, I have two of them. I have them linked together. They're still my analog routing, and I have a patch bay with about 500 points on it, which is over on this side. And I can get to anything I want to get to here, and eventually it all goes through D to A, A to D, and then into the computer, and I can do all my stuff here in the computer.
Well, the interesting thing that I find here is that you never chase the trends. When I looked at your gear list and I saw the speakers that you have, it's like, well, this is what was popular and really worked well at one time, and it's still working well today for you. Why change?
It's true. It's like, if it sounds good on these speakers, then it'll sound good anywhere. And I remember I was working at Electrosound when we had access to buy JBL stuff because we were a JBL dealer. And I remember when these speakers came in for somebody, I remember doing a sweep test on them and I'm going, these things are flatter than any speaker that I've heard. There's no bumps or this or that or whatever. It just sounded very neutral to me. So I'm going, I'm going to buy a pair of these and use them for my studio. I mean, of course I had Auratones, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Auratones. But these, I've only had to, I think, replace the woofer once in each with a reconed woofer.
What are you driving them with?
I'm using an old Kenwood hi-fi amp.
Huh.
With preamp section and everything. I mean, a small little slimline guy that I probably had for 35 years. I don't have a Hafler. I don't have a Bryston. I don't have any of this stuff. I don't have any of these like mega speakers. I did have the sense in this facility, of course, to have non-parallel walls. So when I designed this facility, it was like, okay, here's what the pattern's going to look like, and there's going to be no reflections. I don't have any acoustic treatment or trapping or anything like that. It's just the shape of the place and the fact that I have no really even surfaces or reflective surfaces. But I just know that if it sounds good here, and I listen in the car, and if I listen in my living room, it's like, okay, I think we got it. I could never afford this stuff. That's the reason why I have what I have.
Sure.
You know, I could never afford, I mean, I'm glad that I didn't like get financing on like a $500,000 board. I would have been like, what good was this going to do me?
You know? Yeah, right.
But I figured if the Beatles could get the sounds and the quality that they got from the equipment they had, it's all about what you do with the equipment you have. It's like, you got to have a good song to have a good song. No amount of gear or technology or production value is going to make a bad song a good song.
You know, you mentioned before about going to recording school and recording speakers. When I first moved to California, I got a job with Everything Audio, the gear dealer, if you remember them.
Yeah, Everything Audio, I remember.
Yeah, and one of my clients was Cherokee Studios. And I remember going down there, and they had a whole, I don't want to say division, but they had several people that were dedicated just to Recone speakers.
Wow.
Because they were so fanatical that after every project, they would pull all the woofers out and they'd Recone everything because they felt it sounded better. So this was a constant process for them. But I can remember that the people that were taking me around were very reverential about the speaker room, and there'd be dozens of woofers. It'd be like going to JBL, but they're going, yeah, there's something very cool in there. I don't know if it's the magnets or what. And I'm thinking to myself, no, it's the glue.
The glue. Yeah. And the solvent was called MEK, methyl ethyl ketone. And it was pretty nasty stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Well, okay. So let's talk about Data Sound then. I noticed that among your clients, you have a lot of film and television actors. And I'm just curious, what kind of sessions were those that you were doing with them?
Well, our sessions came from a lot of different places, of course. When I first started the studio and before we were here in Burbank, which is really my first really pro facility, it was all mostly independent singer-songwriters and stuff like that. But once we got here and I was looking for engineers, because I was doing all the engineering myself, but in the process of looking for engineers, I found a great guy named Jim Latham, who went on to become a pretty well-known TV composer for animation and other things like that. He did Dragon Tales and a bunch of other things. And at one point, he was one of the top ASCAP writers of the year and that kind of a thing. But Jim was also a great engineer, and he was a great person on the phone who knew that if you didn't have clients coming in, you get on the phone and you start drumming up business. And one of the clients that he drummed up was a guy named Chuck Cassie from Viacom. So when Chuck came in with Viacom, and with Viacom came Dick DeBenedictis, composer, film composer and stuff, and his son Dean, we started getting projects in that were tied in with Viacom projects. So some celebrities ended up coming up along for the ride on that. You know, Dick Van Dyke came in to do something as part of the Murder Incorporated or whatever TV thing he was doing, right? He came in and recorded a song or a rap song of all things, right? They needed a rap tune. Rodney Dangerfield ended up coming in on some movie project thing called The Fourth Tenor, singing something or whatever. We just ended up pulling in some very interesting people from the Viacom part. And then on the other end is a rock journalist that I've been working with since the early 80s named Harvey Kubernick.
Yeah.
Okay, do you know Harvey?
I know who he is, but I don't know him. Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, Harvey's a character, and he was fascinated by the fact that Danny Elfman and I went to school together and we were friends. And he was always talking Baldwin Hills, Baldwin Hills, Baldwin Hills, because that's where we lived. That's where the school was. And I used to go to Danny's house, and we played music on his piano, and we did all kinds of stuff. So Harvey, he has connections to all kinds of celebrities because he's a rock journalist. He brought Ray Manzarek in to do a 2-CD spoken word set of the true history of the Doors.
Oh.
After Ray Manzarek had walked off the set of Oliver Stone's film because he said, this is bullshit. They were like technical advisors, right? The remaining Doors guys. And he walked out. He said, this is bullshit. You know, he said, I'm giving you my input and you're making this movie. He said, that's not Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
And so he ended up recording a 2-CD set with piano interludes on our Yamaha C5 grand piano called The Doors, Myth and Reality. And it was a beautiful project. And I still have a CD of that project up on the wall. And Ray was just such a great guy. You know, he's just very personable, very fun. Harvey asked questions, but the questions were edited out. And it was just a Ray talking. So he brought in Ray Manzarek. He brought in Katie Segal from Married with Children to do spoken word poetry. Because he brought in a lot of people who normally didn't, we know them as doing something else, like singing or being a guitar player. And he had them doing spoken word poetry records, all kinds of stuff. I mean, that's Harvey. And so from Harvey, we got a number of people in here, including John Wooden, the basketball coach from UCLA.
Oh, yeah.
And Bill Walton. So I'm just fortunate that, you know, we've been connected with different people. And then the third thing is we had an accompanist, professional accompanist, William Vendice, who used to be the choral master for the LA Chorale. It was a chorus master for LA Opera. And he brought a number of opera singers in here to do their demos and recordings with. So I met some really cool opera singers, and Placido Domingo was one of them. Wow. That came in with his own accompanist, who was a woman. But that connection opened up bringing in people like that. So it's just been very interesting where people ended up finding us. And then the fact that we were so low key and nobody would ever, you know, be swarming around trying to like do paparazzi or whatever, because we're just so hidden. And that was also a good factor for them. It was like, hey, we're going to this private studio. Nobody knows where we are. So, and you've seen the mugs on our wall, you know, our little mug club.
Yeah.
And that's where most of our names are engraved in the mugs in perpetuity, even if they're no longer with us.
See, the cool thing about that is the fact you get clients in that don't care about the gear. Whereas if you were trying to get, you know, mostly rock clients or music clients, and producers and engineers can be very persnickety about what kind of gear, and you don't have to worry about that so much.
Yeah, you're totally right. And I like the fact that the barrier was we didn't have the money to get the gear that I thought you needed.
Yeah.
But a great example of this is that when I was a kid growing up, I remember hearing the song by Mel Carter that's become a worldwide standard, Hold Me, Thrill Me, Kiss Me, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was back in the 60s. And as a kid, I remember being moved by this tune, but I didn't know why. I was just too young. Years later, through one connection or another, Mel comes to my studio and wants me to mix a song. Now, he brings a 24-track reel-to-reel, and we don't have 24-track. So I rented the reel-to-reel, and I interfaced it with our stuff, and I mixed this tune for him. And he was just thrilled with the result. So then the next 10 years, I did 3 albums with him here, including Big Band. Wow. In our studio. And it's some of the best work I've ever done, because I'm a big fan of the Buddy Rich album, Mercy, 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 live at Caesar's Palace, 1968. One of the best Big Band albums ever. And I listened to that thing and I'm going, that's what Big Band should sound like. So when Mel came in and some of the tracks on his tune with Big Band, I go, okay, this is my yardstick. I want this band to sound like that. And when we were done with the project, it's like, it's exciting. It's like, it's kick-ass. And even with the drums that I have, like the drummer used my kit, was a mid-60s Slingerland maple kit. I tell the drummers, bring your own cymbals and snare and your own kick pedal, and you can use our drums if you like. You know, most of them go, yes, this is a good kit. We'll use that. I haven't had it mic'd the same way for 30 years. My overheads are Countryman Isomax Ultra miniatures that I have in a little mounted on a little wire thing hanging from a rubber band. That's my overheads.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then I've got Shure mics on all the toms and the snare. And I have the poor man's RE20 on the kick, which is the PL20, right? That was the poor man's, right? And on the hi-hat, I think I have like a little condenser mic that Fender put out some years ago. And you know, that's it. I have eight mics. I have a mic panel in the drum booth. And I have 8 channels on the board, and I run it through the Ramza, and then we put them on separate channels, and that's the drum kit. And I've been recording drums the same way for all these years. The result of what we ended up getting is just, it's what you do with the gear you've got.
Yeah.
I like the fact that I've been able to do that. And you're right. People who come to me, they don't care about the gear. They want to hear, well, you have an example of some stuff that you've done, and I play them some stuff, and they go, okay, I want to record here. Because that's all that matters, right? I mean, I love how the Beatles sound, but nobody's got equipment like that anymore. You know?
Before, we're talking about the parallels in our careers, and that's one big band, for instance. I used to teach at Berklee way, way back, Berklee College of Music. And of course, there was big bands all the time, and I'd be recording them one way or another, either in the studio or we'd be doing live in the concert hall. So I, to some degree, cut my chops on big band recording. And it's one of those things where once you do it, it sets a bar. It's like, okay, I know what things should sound like because I've gone through that. I've listened to it all. I know what it's like on the floor, and I know what it's like, you know, when it's recorded. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I got it. Did you happen to watch that Mel Carter big band video that's on that article on my website on the homepage?
No, I didn't, but I will.
Yeah, if you go to the Mel Carter article, a couple of pages down will be the YouTube video. And I actually shot video of a lot of a particular recording session from the third album. I had six cameras going. And then I edited it later in post. And it was pretty much a live thing except for Lenny Welch's overdub. But the video is exciting. And you get to see all the players. Steve Pemberton on drums, James Leary on bass, Grant Geisman on guitar. John Robbie, the musical director, on piano. We have five brass players and four saxes. Many of them are in the household names in studios. As Mel always got the best. And he put the charts out there and was like, two takes, all right, next song, you know? And he would sing live in the booth.
Oh, I love it.
It was a phenomenal. Everybody was so good and Mel was so good. So if you watch that video, you're going to not only hear the mix, but you're going to see the guys playing in real time.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to watch it as soon as we finish this here.
Yeah, you'll see. It's a lot of fun.
I have a question for you. So you eventually began to offer other services, graphics and online marketing and website design and everything, which shows me that you're very, very technical, or at least you have that bent. If something comes up that is technical, you can handle it. You'll figure it out. Where did that come from?
Well, actually, it's funny that you mentioned that. When I was in junior high school, and we had industrial arts classes. Every semester was a different discipline. So I learned how to make things with wood. I learned how to make things with metal. I learned how to go into print shop and do old-fashioned typesetting one letter at a time with lead type from a box, ink up the press, the whole bit, right? Drafting was a semester, so you learned technical drawing, plastics and leatherwork. I mean, we had all these really cool shop classes. And those would serve me well as time went on. So when computers came out and software started coming out on computers, one of the first things I dove into was professional typesetting packages. Because I come from the era when the first desktop publishing packages were PageMaker and Ventura.
Yeah.
Those were the two big ones, right? And I was on a PC, so I went with Ventura, which was a very hard program to learn. But once you learned it, you could do way more than PageMaker. But PageMaker was more artistic, but it was more like a single page layout thing. And Ventura was designed to make manuals that were 1,000 pages long. So I had to try and take that and turn it into something that could actually make art and still be able to do books and things like that. So when I got to a point where I needed some artwork done for a cassette J card for a client, I hired somebody to put something together. I said, here's what we want for this project. I didn't really consider myself a graphic designer. I'd done typesetting. I'd done my newsletter. I knew about type. I was pretty good with that. But I turned it over to somebody else. And when the guy brought me back the result for the money that I was paying for it, I looked at it and was like, well, I could have done a better job than that. That opened a new career for me. It was like, okay, I'm going to create my own little graphics design business because I know I've got the skills to be able to do that. And once I did, I expanded my tools. I got into CorelDRAW in such a big way that I became a user group leader and a seminar leader and did seminars and conventions across North America teaching people how to use CorelDRAW. I actually set these things up. I became an entrepreneur entirely in that field, right? I mean, it was crazy, you know, just flying everywhere, hotels, the whole bit, teaching people how to create. Because Corel was for Windows, and it was purchased by all these companies. It was a huge hit. It was the biggest graphic design hit program, way more than any Mac program, because businesses had PCs, not Macs, and Macs are such a small percentage of that overall world. And so they would get CorelDRAW and tell their people in whatever department, okay, do all of our promo materials now, do all of our branding, do all of this. And these guys had no clue because they weren't graphic designers. So I feel the need of being able to present my knowledge and my technical skills to show people how to use these programs and get, you know, decent work done. And that for 3 years, that's what I did. You know, I just traveled to even while I had Jim in the studio, you know, doing my engineering. That was mid-90s. So that one instance opened up a whole new career for me. And it was called Theta Data Type and Design.
Oh, I love it. That's great.
You know, that was the name. And I did a DBA and everything. And then shortly thereafter, video started coming into its own on the computer. Now, I got three-quarter U-matics right here. I have JVC, two of them. I have an editing deck and a playback deck, right? And I have two monitors and I have a little... So I'd already been familiar with doing, you know, cuts only A-B editing and that sort of thing. So when the stuff came out for computers, it's like, oh, we can do this on computer. So I wrote this ballet called The Snow Queen that the artistic director, that's a whole other story. But the first year, they had somebody videotape with one camera, right? We didn't know it was going to be a big show. It just turned out to be like, okay, we're doing the show and here's somebody that record it. So I gave the video guy a feed from my audio because I did the audio playback. I did all the tracks playback for this show and I gave him a feed. And then when I found out what he had done, he had just used his camera mic with bottles dropping on the floor and all kinds of noise and crap. The camera work wasn't bad, but the audio was horrendous. And the package was just completely non-packaged. It was like a tape with a cutout white box and a label with his company name on it and the title of the show. I told the artistic director, I said, do not let any of these tapes out. I said, I'm going to completely remaster this. So I took the video master, which was shot on SVHS, and I retracked in the entire audio track. I used his mic for the applause and I brought it in and out. And I did the whole thing on a digital timeline and I made new graphics, a beautiful package. And then we released the video and it was like night and day. So all of a sudden it's like, okay, looks like I'm doing the video from now on. Next year we did a three camera shoot and the technology was coming along on Windows. And I started using Premiere in the early days and just put just thousands of hours into learning video, professional video. So that by the time, after so much amount of time, I could charge people for doing it. I'd go, hey, you know, I'll shoot video, whatever. And that just became yet another career, was video. Not just a little bit of video, a lot of video. And then when the web came along, it's like all of this stuff goes into that. Graphics, web clips, audio, copywriting, it all goes into a website. And you have to be able to put all the technology together. And I just found that I love these challenges. I'm going, you know, I see what's supposed to happen on the other end. So I'm not going to let this get in my way. I'm going to learn what I need to learn to get over to the other side. And when that program stops me or stumps me, I'm going, there's something wrong with this program, which is why I still have a lot of old software instead of upgrading every single year. I still have old versions of things that still work to this day. Some of them are 30 years old.
Yeah.
But the audio stuff, a lot of the stuff, you have to buy new stuff because it wasn't invented back then. In my main studio here, I'm still using like a about maybe 15-year-old DAW called Samplitude.
I remember it, yeah.
Yeah, the Sequoia and Samplitude, same company. I have a newer version, but the older version is great. It does everything I need, you know, in real time, non-destructive, you know. Even pitch changing, everything. It's a very excellent system. I was using Logic for Windows, and then Apple bought the company, and they dropped the Windows product. After I spent years getting good at Logic, that was a pisser because they were not going to resurrect the Windows product. So then I had to make the switch to, I picked Cubase to be my sequencer. And so I'm glad when they sold to Yamaha because Yamaha didn't drop the product. They kept both platforms going. So I have Cubase 10 on the system I'm talking to you on now, which is a Windows 7 system, by the way. And I have a brand new system that I just built, this Windows 11, but I built it for video enhancement and AI restoration, which requires a humongous graphics card and a humongous CPU power that my Windows 7 isn't going to be able to do that for me. So if I want to upscale low-res video and stuff, I need this new system. But I can now run this stuff on here if I want to do any audio, but right now most of my audio is right here.
In part two of our interview, you'll hear about how Randall made a left turn to become an artisan baker in addition to being a fine recording engineer. You can find out more about Randall and Random Acts of Breadness at breadness.com. That's breadness.com. And his Theta Sound Studios at thetasound.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.